a sleeper's got to be somebody, if you want to use the term, and I hate the term, it has to be somebody who's so far down and so below that even if you know who he is, it's somebody you don't expect to produce value, or you expect to produce minimal value, who can and probably will produce more.
Good evening, and welcome to episode 46 of Flags Fly Forever, Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Podcast. I am your host, Brett Sayer, and with me, as always, is Mike Gianella and Mauricio Rubio. How are you guys doing on yet another Monday evening?
Well, it's fruit being sold outside weather here in Chicago. So, you know, 50 degrees and gorgeous, so I'm in. I'm good. I'm real good.
We agreed before the recording that now that it's warmer, and I think it was like in the 55 degrees here, we're going to segue off of weather and move on to food. So Mauricio did just that.
Yeah, I'm snacking on a banana.
What are you eating, Brett?
It's cream egg season, man.
That's true. Some people don't like those. I'm kind of on the fence.
I'm a fan.
Yeah.
But anything chocolate and sugar.
I feel like this idea worked before the show and it was more lively. Maybe if now recorded that, we can actually use it. This sort of just tailed off a little bit.
Well, because now we're thinking about the food, which is kind of the issue with talking about food, right?
Yeah, we use all of our good material pre-show.
We do.
It makes me hungry, too.
Sorry, yeah, everybody.
That's all right.
All right. Well, let's not linger in the snack aisle.
We'll try another non-weather segment next week, folks.
That's true. Next week we'll do politics.
No, I'm out.
Nope.
I'm out.
we'll find like people on Twitter, you know, like the hate man or something, and we'll read their tweets.
Yeah, we'll fake like we're going to talk about politics, and then we'll play like Yakety Sax or something.
Now that I'm actually in on, yeah,
100%. All right, so you can read all of us at baseballprospectus.com. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Dynasty Guru. Mike is at Mike Gianella. That's G-I-A-N-E-L-L-A. And Mao's at MRubio52. You can reach us via email at flagsflyforever@baseballprospectus.com. And please rate and review us. We are going to start this week. Work backwards. We are going to talk a lot about the labor expert drafts from this weekend on this episode. See what some of the experts are thinking. See what we can take away from how those auctions fared. We are also going to get into another topic. We're going to talk about sleepers and why you shouldn't bother. And but first, we're going to kick it off with an email. This email is from Andy. It says, "Greetings, gentlemen. I'm in a head-to-head points league with auction draft this year and have some strategy questions. Would you allocate more money for pitching than usual in this style of league? Top pitchers score 800-plus points while top hitters are scoring in the 500s, or should I just go where value takes me? I've never played this style, but I'm under the impression the starters are key to victory. Would you prioritize putting together a team with room for adding streamers weekly? We have a 5-man bench. Any head-to-head point strategy tips in general are appreciated, and my apologies if this topic has been covered before." Thanks, Andy. This topic has not been covered before. It's been asked in a lot of different ways, and I think it's important to kind of discuss what happens when you are dealing with a little bit of a different format and how to adjust. So let's kick it to Mike first. What would your recommendation to Andy be?
Well, I would start out by saying to answer the main question, I would push a little bit more money toward pitching. I probably wouldn't go crazy. And the reason is, even though pitchers score more, or the top pitchers do, there is more variability with pitching than with hitting. Some of the precepts between head-to-head and points and versus roto don't change. So the pitchers you want to aim for, if you're going to do this, are the guys like Kershaw and, you know, to a lesser degree, Felix, you know, the obvious names. I don't need to go through all of them. You don't want to do this in a linear fashion. You definitely don't want to, you know, put too much money, you know, to the guys in the middle, like say DeGrom and Arrieta and some of the guys we'll talk about with, you know, Labor NL, where there's variability. And while we all think we know what they're going to do, some of them are going to kind of fail. I like the streamer idea as well. You know, that's something that works very well in a league that gives you that option. And if there isn't a start limit and you're not dealing with that, then by all means, you know, definitely try to stream, try to maximize your bench. I don't know how deep your league is, Andy, so that's kind of some, or how deep your, how far it would go. So it kind of plays into the question of the bench. But I want to have at least three starting pitchers on a bench like this if it's me.
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been playing head-to-head points for a while. And it sounds like it's sort of similar to you know, the formats that I've been in, and you're absolutely right. While pitchers score more than hitters in these formats, Mike really hit it on the head. You adjust a little bit, but you don't adjust a ton, and it's for both the reason that pitching is unpredictable, and also for the reason that you know, this ties into the conversation why I think we don't have Clayton Kershaw in our top five this year. You know, it's the whole rising tide lifts all boats theory. If the top pitchers are worth a lot, then that means the middle pitchers are also worth a lot in comparison, and the lower end pitchers are also worth a lot in comparison. So the difference, you're really comparing the differences. You're not comparing the absolute values. So maybe the best hitters hit, you know, score, you know, 500 points, but the, you know, not so great hitters score 200. And then the pitchers, the great pitchers score, you know, 800, and the okay ones score, you know, 400. So the differences are there, but they're not that huge. And depending on how deep this league is, you absolutely want to stack your bench with starters. I would probably, if it's not a super deep league, and you have separate DL spots, I would not even waste a bench spot on a position player. I'd go all pitchers and maximize the two start guys that you can get in there. And where I'd really focus on getting pitching is on the depth side and not on the high end talent side, because, you know, we think we know who the best pitchers are going to be, but you know, you're better equipped finding a great starter by drafting four pretty good starters than by drafting one starter you think will be really great. So that's really it. I mean, we get this question in different formats, and you know what, it's just important to know your league, and it sounds like Andy does, and you just you kind of adjust your strategy to take into account what you need to do to win in your particular format. Mal, you have any thoughts before we move on?
Nope, that was covered pretty exhaustively by you guys.
Thanks.
Cool. so let's move on to our topic du jour, or topic du week. How do you say week in French? I didn't take French in high school.
I took no Spanish.
Topic de semana?
Whatever Mao said. Topic de, whatever. we're in the second week of March now, and people have been talking about sleepers for the last 20 years. So we want to talk about sort of what the concept of a sleeper means at this point, once all of the, not all of the, but once about 80% of the preseason fantasy content that's out there has been written, and people have been pumping guys on Twitter, on their websites, everywhere. Mike actually wrote a wonderful piece on this back in January, and I think now is just a really important time to revisit it. So, Mike, I'll kick it to you. Why don't you talk a little bit about sort of the reason why you wrote the piece and sort of what the 10,000 foot thesis is?
Well, I think I wrote the piece, but when I wrote this back in January, it's the beginning of the cycle of information. A lot of the dual baseball football analysts kind of come out and they start pointing at guys who, honestly, even unless you're in an 18 mixed league, everybody knows who these guys are. And the guys I mentioned were Mike Fiers, Carlos Carrasco, AJ Pollock, John Segura, and Colton Wong. All five were identified by one or two sites as sleepers. And, you know, actually, it's really funny. I saw a site somewhere identify Billy Hamilton as a sleeper. You know, it's the reason on one level, the reason the buzzword is dead is because it's used for almost everybody. And I've heard Lenny Melnick, actually, we kind of got into a friendly discussion on this about this on Twitter. He said anyone who's undervalued is a sleeper. It's like, well, you know, in theory, that means that Pedro Martinez in his heyday when he was earning, you know, 50 and people were paying 40 was a sleeper. A sleeper's got to be somebody, if you want to use the term, and I hate the term, it has to be somebody who's so far down and so below that even if you know who he is, it's somebody you don't expect to produce value, or you expect to produce minimal value, who can and probably will produce more.
Yeah, it's kind of like overrated and underrated at this point, right? Like, we've just completely lost sight of where rated is, that we don't really have good terms for anything.
Well, that's a good one. The other concept in fantasy I tie to this that has lost meaning is the, you know, buy low, sell high. That's the other fantasy concept that people say that so much, and it's like, you know, I think the year Verlander was stinking it up. You should buy low. It's like, well, do you think Verlander's owner, you know, after 40 bad innings, is just going to trade him to you for nothing, or do you think he's going to pretty much want almost what he paid for him? Similar thing.
Yeah, you get a lot of you do get leagues out there where stuff like that does happen, but you know, the vast majority of us play in leagues with a little sharper owners than that. So while opportunities do exist, there are always owners that you can sort of poach for value like that. It's not super useful to the masses. So what, you know, if we're sort of rebranding fantasy baseball writing right now, what would you consider a sleeper to be? What would you want the definition of that to be? And give an example of a guy who right now legitimately would fit that definition.
Well, you know, I was kind of looking at last year's list, so I'm just going to go off of last year since it's a little bit easier, and then maybe I'll segue into this year. I think last year a really good example of a sleeper would have been Charlie Blackmon. I'm not talking about for 2015, obviously. I'm talking about for 2014. He was a player who the playing time was kind of uncertain, but there were also some guys in the lineup like Cargo, who kind of, you know, as we all know, is a historic injury candidate, like Drew Stubbs, who we weren't really sure how much he was going to play. You know, and Blackmon was a guy with speed who was playing in cores. So while nobody thought that, you know, Charlie Blackmon would do what he did, I think he was a really excellent candidate for the kind of player you look at, you know, and again, in 2014, and you're like, well, Blackman's a guy who, you know, everybody's looking at and saying, yeah, he's not going to do much. Yeah, he's not worth much, but probably on the conservative side had $15 earning potential. That to me, if you're going to use the term, you know, sort of falls into the sleeper bucket. You know, just kind of scanning the list this year, somebody who I think is a sleeper to me, or a good example of this, is someone like Wilmer Flores. Wilmer Flores is kind of the end of a deep mixed maybe in savvier leagues like Labor, he's going a little bit higher. Single-digit guy in both CBS and the Labor auctions and only. And he's somebody, again, if he stays on the field and if the defense holds up enough, I think he could return, you know, say $15 value. These are the kind of players that, you know, I'm looking at. I think another guy maybe, you know, is, and this was talked about at the first pitch forum I went to this weekend, you know, is Yonder Alonso. Yonder Alonso had some wrist problems last year. He was very unlucky. I don't have all of the baseball HQ metrics in front of me, but he was very unlucky with, you know, a lot of his metrics. And, you know, he's a guy at this point, he's been so bad for so long. We all groan at him. We kind of forget. He's not old by any means. You know, I think he's what, Brett, 25, 26? I think he's 26.
So, he's one of the two, yeah.
Yeah, so he's right in that spot where, you know, and again, I'm not expecting a lot from him. But I think for the price that you can get him for, and particularly in an NL only where first base is bereft, he kind of falls into that sleeper bucket. Sleepers to me are guys with risk too. You know, you can't say Carlos Carrasco or, you know, I think AJ Pollock or is a better example. You can't say AJ Pollock is a sleeper. There just isn't much risk in him until he sails to a price that's say 25 in an only or, you know, eighth round in a mixed league where, then there's the risk, but at that point, he's not a sleeper. He's being taken really high.
Yeah, you get to a situation like what's happening with Steven Souza now, where, you know, kind of coming into, you know, maybe even before the trade, when he really didn't have playing time ahead of him, you know, you could think of him as a deep sleeper, and then he got traded, and then the Pecota projections came out, and everyone was touting him as, you know, as a sleeper, and now he's going. Now he's going in what, 12th, 13th round in drafts?
Yeah. Yeah. He's going pretty high.
Yeah. I think I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mel.
Sorry. I think for me, like the quintessential keeper, you know, or sleeper, sorry. The quintessential keeper or sleeper example that I always think of when these discussions come up is always like the post hype guy. You know, someone like Carlos Gomez, who really failed at a couple of different stops before he really found himself and made a couple of adjustments and turned into the talent that he turned into, you know. And that's a guy who carried a lot of risk, you know, because the talent was clearly there and a lot of people were still willing to buy the talent well up until he started producing. And then, you know, he blew up. And that's, you know, that's a guy who I always, you know, the post-type guys I always associate with being sleepers.
Yeah, and there's no
way to put it.
Yeah, and there's no shortage of those guys now. You know, I think, you know, someone who I don't think is nearly as talented as Carlos Gomez, but has sort of the same, you know, looking, maybe not looking at a ton of playing time if he doesn't kind of fight his way into it and has the prospect pedigree. A guy like Jake Mariznek in Houston, he's someone who, you know, has the talent to, on talent alone, he could return, you know, near $20 in AL only leagues, but you know he's not going to cost nearly that just because he's also quite risky. And you know, as strange as it sounds, they might not have a ton of playing time for him in Houston if he doesn't quite hit out of the chute. So I think Mao's absolutely right. It's guys like that are real sleepers at this point, and the guys who are quote unquote sleepers at the beginning of the off season are now just valued. They're, you know, they've gotten hyped enough, they've moved from actually being a sleeper to that advice just not being useful anymore. Just because you're not going to, Carlos Carrasco is a perfect example. You're not going to get Carlos Carrasco at a discount in drafts this year.
Yeah, Marcus Stroman's another one like that. And if you want a good litmus test for sleepers, I was just thinking of this. If somebody says sleeper, and I think this guy's a sleeper, if somebody says sleeper, Ike Davis, and your gut reaction or to whoever the player is like, ugh, what are you talking about? And then you read the argument, that's a sleeper where your gut reaction is like, nah, I don't want that guy. And then you kind of dive into it and you're like, well, wait a minute. You know, I kind of see the point here for the price he's going for and for what he can bring to the table. He's a sleeper. And Davis is another example. He's a guy who it's not that far off the radar. He hit for power. You know, he's out of New York. You know, he's one more year removed from the Valley Fever. I actually am not a huge Davis fan, but at the price he's going for, he's a guy on the back end of a reserve list in a mixed, or, you know, for, he went for three in labor, you know, for $6 or $7. I think he's a pretty good gamble in an AL only.
So is this still a bad time to make the case for Peter Borges super sleeper?
I still like Borges, actually.
Yeah, I actually kind of like it.
Well, he had that hip surgery, and, you know, nobody talks about it, but that hip's been bugging him for like 2 or 3 years. I think at the very least, even off the bench, he could fly.
I think so.
And he can still play defense. So he still has a way to force himself into the lineup and be valuable, even if the bat's not quite there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. So enjoy your sleepers while you can, and be prepared to draft the next level of players that no one's really talking about, because those are going to be the ones that are actually the sleepers in your draft. And we'll be right back. Welcome back to episode 46 of Flags Fly Forever, Baseball Prospectus Fantasy Podcast. Now we are going to go and get into this weekend's labor excitement. In Arizona, we had the American League auction on Saturday and the National League auction on Sunday. So Mike is our expert league maven. He has written the AL recap, which is going to be up when you hear this, and the National League one will follow shortly thereafter. So let's start with Mike. So let's start very macro. What was the biggest takeaway from the AL labor auction, and what were some good examples of that?
Well, I think the AL of the two leagues, the AL is kind of more predictable. And the last couple of years since I've been writing about this and tracking it as its own article, not much has really changed. Like the owners in that league are a pretty predictable bunch. The labor composition, I think, unlike Tout Wars, stays almost the same every year. And you really see this kind of manifest in the AL. You can almost set your watch by the way people, you know, kind of go out and spend their money. So hitting was about 69% of the overall pie. Pitching was about 31%. That was almost exactly the same as last year. The top pitchers cost $30 less, but a lot of that could be explained by Yu Darvish suddenly going down. He actually went for $1 to Tristan Cockcroft. When I say it went down 30, I should say compared to CBS a couple weeks ago. So as far as trends go, I think, you know, a lot of what you see and what I saw was a lot of spending early, a lot of aggressive prices, and some bargains at the end, particularly on the hitting side.
So what were some pitching prices that really surprised you on the AL side?
Well, let's see here. So, you know, just kind of taking a look at closers fell a little bit. I think that I was a little surprised to see that, because while closer prices are often cheap in these expert leagues, I was a little surprised to see Zach Britton, for example, go for 14. I know you like him, Brett. I like him too. I didn't really think his price would fall that much, given that he has the job. I think Phil Yu's going for 13 surprised me. I know about the concerns with him. I know that some people think he's going to slip a little bit, but that strikes me as the kind of price where there just isn't much of a a cushion for failure. You know, and another price that I really liked, and you know I like this guy, is Danny Duffy for $7. I get some of the concerns with Duffy, but when you're going all the way down to $7 on him, it seems like you're almost completely insulated from the downside.
Yeah, there were a couple of guys that stuck out like that to me in sort of the exact same way. So one guy I noticed which sort of falls along those same lines is Ervin Santana, who, you know, is in Minnesota now. There certainly won't be a ton of opportunity for wins, but he's a guy who should throw a ton of innings, and, you know, in that park should put up pretty decent ratios and strikeouts. And he went for single digits as well. He went to for $8 to Chris Liss, which I thought was a really nice buy. Even like going lower down than that, sticking on the same team, a guy like Kyle Gibson, who really doesn't have a ton by way of upside, but has a fair amount of job security and should be able to kind of hold down the back of a rotation. Went for $2, and, you know, there are plenty of guys who went in the, you know, sort of $3 to $6 range who I'd certainly prefer Gibson to. But Mal, any guys on the pitching side jump out to you as either noticeably high or noticeably low?
You know, I always think that Eric Johnson's interesting just as a $1 gamble bid, but I'm a notoriously big believer in Johnson, so I mean that's probably not too crazy. I thought Yordano was kind of an interesting bid. Mike, how was the bidding on Yordano there?
Well, actually, you know, unlike the NL, I wasn't around for as much of the AL, so I didn't see how that played out or when he came up. I do agree. I think his price, he went for 13 in labor. He went for 14 in CBS. I do think his price kind of slipped a little bit. I'm probably a little bit higher on Yordano than some, but that still seems a couple bucks cheaper than where I expected him to go.
Yeah, and just for reference, Yordano Ventura went for $13, just to kind of give you the gauge. Zach Britton went for $14, and Brad, I know that's your guy, but come on now.
Don't besmirch Zach Britton. Do not do that.
I'm not.
That will not make me happy.
I also thought Tyler Clippard was an interesting bit as well. Did you see that one, Mike, or no?
No, I didn't, although, you know, to kind of comment in a broader sense, and this is especially true in the American League, between injuries and unsettled bullpens, there are a lot of prices and situations that intrigue me. Like, I think Sean Doolittle, who, you know, is the other half of that pen, went for $8, and Clippard, you know, Clippard went for $10. So Clippard, who, assuming Doolittle's okay, probably, you know, Doolittle will probably get more saves, but somebody is gambling on the fact that Tyler Clippard is going to be the man there and that Doolittle is not going to be healthy. I thought another interesting situation was the Astros bullpen. You had Luke Gregerson go for $6. I think Josh Fields went for $3, which, you know, kind of surprised me a little bit, but I know he did go for $3. Some people always love Josh Fields. I think Chad Qualls went for $4. And Pat Neshek went for $2. So it was like nobody could decide on the Astros, so the money was just spread all around.
Yeah, I mean, as strange as it sounds to say it, they have some actual good pitchers in their bullpen this year. So it's not as shitty as a closer roundup as it was last year when, you know, Qualls kind of won it by default and then was half decent before he kind of fell down again.
Real quick, just since we're on shitty bullpens, boy, Bruce Rondon got reserve rounded. So, you know, it's always a positive. Yeah.
He was another guy I talked up at first pitch very highly based on potential strikeout and, you know, his injury last year. And, you know, again, you're talking about as a reserve sleeper, but Yeah, that's a fun thing about these mono leagues. Like, you can really just bury guys on your reserve, and you don't really have a lot to lose if they don't work out.
Yeah, it's fine. It's just funny. I like seeing his name every once in a while.
Yeah, there's always funny names when you get to the bench.
Yeah, is it strange that someone actually took a player I've legitimately never heard of in the reserve round?
Happens every year.
Does anyone actually know the last reserve pick that Perry Van Hook took?
I don't.
Mal?
I don't even know how I can pronounce that.
I want to hear Mal.
Atahualpa? I don't know who that is, but...
Mal, even if you're pronouncing it wrong, it sounds so beautiful when you say it.
Well, this got weird in a hurry.
Wow.
Not that weird.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. No, I have no idea who the hell that is. I feel like I've seen the name, but I just don't know who that is.
I think they just made it up.
Oh, yeah. Wouldn't be the first time.
No. There's a lot of Tommy John guys taken in the reserve round. it just goes to show you how many Tommy John guys there really are. I'm just scrolling through. You got Gavin Floyd, who's still somewhere on the comeback trail from Tommy John.
He's still Gavin Floyd, right?
Yeah, we think so. We got AJ Griffin. We've got I'll lump Danny Holtzen in because he's coming back from major injury. Just not Tommy John. Same with Matt Harrison. And then Ivan Nova, Martin Perez. The list just goes on and on and on. I really like Perez as a reserve pick in AL only league, just because he had his Tommy John somewhat early, so there's a reasonable chance he could be back in July. So 3 months of, you know, what could be a half-decent pitcher. He was someone with who was developing, you know, pretty good command before he got injured. So, maybe he comes back and does some things right off the bat. But once you're getting down to the point where someone's taking Alex Yarbrough, then it's time to take Martin Perez
and Gavin Floyd.
And Gavin Floyd, sure. I was surprised that Chris Capuano went in the reserve round. I thought he would be drafted. That was probably the guy who I looked at in the reserve round and was most surprised he was not at least a dollar or two in the auction.
There's so much. The thing about pitching, and you know, we recently made a rule change in our home league. We just added a 10th pitcher. When fantasy baseball started, major league teams were carrying 10 pitchers and 15 hitters, and fantasy teams had 9 pitchers. Now teams carry 12 pitchers, and we still carry 9 pitchers. So there's more variability than there used to be, and I think that's what ties into this. And particularly in a league like Labor, where you can speculate on minor league guys in the auction, because you see a lot of guys like Dylan Bundy, like Kendall Graveman, and you know, I know that Ray Flowers, I read his recap today. He thinks Graveman might be up. I don't think he will to start the season. But you see a lot of that speculation. So, you know, as a result, I think you get guys, and I agree with you, Brett, like Capuano. I think Jeremy Guthrie is another good example. Jeremy Guthrie is probably going to play. And a rule, you know, one of the rules in Labor is that if you take a guy, you can't reserve active players, which you can do in Tout Wars, you can do in CBS. But the reserves, as long as you don't cut them, you can freely activate them and reserve them all year long. So grabbing a guy like a Capuano and a Guthrie and streaming them in a league like this where you can't stream everybody is a huge thing.
Yeah, and even just kind of looking at guys who are, you know, I guess in competition with each other and sort of the differences you see like that. And you talk about Kendall Graveman, who went for $5. Sean Nolan wasn't even taken in the reserve round.
Nolan over Graveman.
I would take Nolan over Graveman as well. And you know, people are talking about Graveman just because he's more in people's cerebral cortex at the moment. But Nolan's the better pitcher. And you know, whether you think that wins out over the course of 2015 is somewhat irrelevant, but there should not be that much of a difference between the two of them.
I agree.
So let's get off pitching for a bit and talk about the hitters. We were talking about this a little bit before before offline. Where was that sort of middle ground in this draft where players seem to get bid up with some of the extra savings that was floating around?
Well, I think a lot of that happened early. I think that the labor crowd is more aggressive, and in particular, it's more aggressive in the AL and the NL. It's more aggressive than it was, I'd say, a couple years ago when 40 was sort of the magical stopping point for a hitter, and even going 35 was kind of a difficult thing. You know, this year we saw. You know, Jose Abreu went for 37, and I know people are excited about Abreu, and I think some of the talk about his downside is overstated, but he's a guy last year who I think earned like 33 or 34. There is a ceiling with him, and because he doesn't run, I think you're really chasing him at best to that ceiling. You know, Prince Fielder went for 30. That's kind of another example of a guy where I'm like, you know, I get it. Prince Fielder's a, you know, to use Mao's term, you know, he's a guy when he's healthy, but he's coming off of something pretty serious, and I'm really reluctant to kind of pay the full freight for Fielder.
Yeah, that was really the one price that jumped out at me and kind of made me say whoa when I saw them come across. And you know, $30 for Fielder a couple years ago would have been a bargain, but you know, there's so much risk around where he's going to come back to that you know, that's a tough number to get to.
Yeah, a lot of these prices in the top tier, they're not bad. They're just you know, they're aggressive. Miguel Cabrera at 35 is kind of an unknown. That's aggressive. Encarnacion at 33, and I talked about this last year with him. A lot of people say the average could come up. If that average doesn't come up, he just can't get there. You know, Jose Bautista, similar in a BA league as opposed to an OBP league, 33 is probably about his ceiling. There's a lot of players like this in the top tier to me. Josh Donaldson's another one at 31. Nothing wrong with these prices. They're just prices where you're paying the premium. This is pretty much what you're going to get, and if anything goes wrong, you're going to lose money on them.
Yeah, and especially when you compare, the one number that jumps out as sort of the reasonable number in all of this aggressiveness is Adam Jones for $30.
Yep. Yeah,
I mean he's right in there, talent wise and value wise, with a lot of these guys that went in the, you know, 30, you know, 33 to $35 range, especially given the depth of the league. So I thought that was a great buy at that price.
Yeah, and I think the funny thing about that is I think it's a really solid buy, and to kind of the next buys that are kind of even close, you got to go down a while to like Pujols at 26, Jose Reyes at 24. It takes some time to find that next group because Ian Kinsler, I like at 21, but you got to kind of get down to the low to mid 20s to find those players that even look like mild bargains. So that's kind of what makes Jones good to me here as well. He's a foundational player, and comparatively speaking, he's a bargain compared to a lot of those other top foundational players.
Yeah, and you know, the difference between the cross compare between some of the positional players is interesting. The another guy that jumped out at me besides Fielder for the aggressiveness was Brian Dozier, who went for 27 to Tim Heaney. And not that that's a bad buy. It feels aggressive compared to the $30 that was spent on Robinson Cano and the $31 that was spent on Jose Altuve. It's you know, when you're talking about where those players should be, if everyone's being aggressive, then you'd expect those other second basemen to clock in a little bit higher than that. But barring that, I think you sort of see with Dozier at 27 and Kipnis at 27, you really see where the second base market drops off in the American League, because it gets really, really steep. You don't want to be the you don't really want to be the guy who's starting Stephen Drew or Robert Refsnyder. It's a rough crop when you get down to the bottom.
Yeah, after Marcus Semien, who went for 13, yeah, it really drops into some guys where you're either taking a chance or you're getting someone like Omar Infante who's okay, but unless he bounces all the way back, you're taking a bit of a statistical hit there.
Yeah. As opposed to sort of the some of the shortstops who I thought were pretty decent values. I mean, you sort of compare that to Brad Miller, who went for $4, and where's the other one? D. Gregorius, who went for $3. Yeah. Those guys are, when you get down to the bottom of the shortstop barrel, it's a little bit more attractive than the bottom of the second base barrel.
Yeah, even, and we've made fun of him at BP, but, even Josh Rutledge at four, he's probably going to start. I don't love him, but at that price, to get a guy who can potentially start for three or four, and again, this is the only versus the mix. Guys like, especially Gregorius and Rutledge, I think even in a 15-team mixed, they're bench guys at best. There's not really a lot of upside, particularly for Rutledge outside of Colorado. And in only, you need those. If you can get starting players at three or four to score you runs, drive in runs, everything else is gravy, and you're going to pull a profit as long as they keep the chop.
Yeah. It's absolutely true. I mean, you can't overstate that. I guess my final thought on the AL, do you guys have any final thoughts? I want to give a shout out to the team of Rick Wolf and Glenn Colton, who rostered Jesus Montero for $1. I know he's sort of, it's sort of become a way too running joke at this point, but I really do like that buy at $1. I think that's really, really solid. Anyone have any other closing thoughts before we move on to the National League?
This was kind of the upside auction, wasn't it? With Abysel Garcia for 19, Wolof. There were some other guys who were pretty up there, like Souza went for 15. Some of the younger guys kind of went for higher prices than I was expecting.
Yeah, I think there's a trend, and there's a bit of this in the NL too, but there's definitely so many of these upside rookies. It was a little more conservative than CBS, although I think Mookie Betts went to the Ambrosius Childs team for 22. Every time I see a Betts price or slot, I love Mookie Betts, but people just got to back off a little bit. It's just really hard. It's going to be really hard to see him return that kind of value this year.
It might be hard for him to get the playing time to even return the value, even if he's as good as everyone thinks he is.
I know, but then you're right, but it's both ways. Even if he gets a playing time, for him to get to 22, it's going to take so much.
Exactly. So let's jump ship. Let's jump to the National League. We saw something a little different in the National League here. So Mike, why don't you walk us through what your big takeaway was here?
Well, it took me a while to get to it. Mao asked a couple times during the AL segment, did you watch this? Did you watch that? And I was out, and people following me on Twitter know I was actually at a High School Musical, which to tell you why would probably take way too long, although now I realize that it sounds really creepy if I don't tell you. So the short answer is my daughter had a friend. They had some younger kids in the cast who was in the show. So that's why I went to the show. So not creepy at all. To segue back into labor, so I was home for NL Labor, and I did catch a lot of the action. So last year at NL Labor, the prices were really conservative early. Cargo went for 36, Kutch went for 35, I think Goldschmidt went for 33 or 34. And we talked about this last year. We're all surprised, like, oh my gosh, like nobody's spending anything. And there was a spike in the middle. This year, the spending was, it was appropriate. It looked appropriate at first. You know, Kutch went for 39, Stanton went for 36, Goldschmidt went for 38. So, you know, there was a bargain. I thought Carlos Gomez at 32 was a bargain, but the prices looked, you know, appropriate at the beginning. And then the other thing is, you know, pitching is usually conservative, but Lore Michaels of Masters Ball spent 40 on Kershaw, and he called him out at 40. That was his plan. He wanted to call him out and see what happened because he knew, and people told him afterward, you know, if he called Kershaw out for like 30 or 32, people would have bid him up, and he might have sailed past 40 and right to 40. And Max Scherzer went for 32. I can't remember the last time in NL that two pitchers cracked 30. It's been a long, long time. So far, this looked like a pretty normal auction. But then, you know, all of a sudden, the pitching prices in the second tier, first they leveled off, and then they started to fall. So the leveling off came with a few guys. It started with well, the last guy who went high was Steven Strasburg at 27. And the leveling off kind of started guys like Johnny Cueto at 20. You saw Adam Wainwright go for 19. Zach Greinke went for 21. John Lester went for 19. I'd classify all these as fair or a bit of a bargain. Cole Hamels went for 21, fell into that. But then suddenly you started seeing some pitchers like Jake Arrieta go for 16, James Shields go for 15, Julio Teheran went for 16. Just a clump of pitching prices where suddenly guys are going a couple dollars cheaper. And what was happening, there were a couple things happening. So you've got Doug Dennis of Baseball HQ. He always spends about $30 on his pitching staff. And he almost never makes any bones about it. It's not a secret that he's going to spend $30 on or so on his pitching staff. But the other thing is you had a couple other owners hanging back this year a little bit more than usual. So it's always kind of hard to adjust to this. I think there's no excuse not to adjust to Dennis because he's been in this auction for years. But because some of the other owners hung back on pitching or they bought one big arm and sat back, there was really a buying opportunity. So the teams in the pitching side that were better off, they weren't the teams like Lars who bought Kershaw for 40, or the teams that bought a couple of pitchers like early, like I mentioned Teheran, but Dalton Daldon of Yahoo bought Matt Harvey for 24. We can talk about that later if you want. And Julio Teheran for 16. The guys who are better off, you know, Steve Moyer, like, you know, I talked about this to a few people on Twitter. You know, I really like Tyson Ross for 12, Jacob deGrom for 12, Lance Lynn for 8. You know, that's just a really strong top three for me.
Yeah, the guy that, you know, we talked about this this afternoon, actually. The guy that jumps out at me as being crazy undervalued, besides Jacob deGrom, we talked about that, $12. I don't know how he goes for $12 in this auction. But Gio Gonzalez went for $13. That's just that price kind of jumped out at me. Just because, you know, I would have assumed he would have gone, you know, in the sort of $16 to $18 range, and that would have been a pretty decent price for him. The pitching depth across the National League is strong, and when you get owners that are backing off, the opportunistic owners will step in and do pretty much what Steve Moyer did and kind of clean up and really not have to spend all that much on a really, really strong staff. And there are other examples of it too. I mean, we have Lore Michaels did spend $40 on Clayton Kershaw, but you know, even if he hadn't, you know, his next couple of starters after Kershaw are really strong. He got Gio Gonzalez for $13. He got Brandon McCarthy for $14, which is not a that's a pretty decent buy. It's more or less par, but it's definitely a buyer's market if you were in that market at that time.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I think that there was a wave there, and regardless of how you feel about some of these pitchers, at worst they were par, at best they were pretty good bargains.
Mm-hmm. Mal, anything else jump out to you in this group?
Rosenthal for 15. Kashner for 11 and Kennedy for 11. In contrast to DeGrom, were kind of interesting to me. You kind of stole my DeGrom point there, but I think those were some fairly interesting prices.
Yeah, we should talk about the fact that the closers, and this happened last year in labor, and it was a repeat performance this year. And I actually didn't go back to look at who dumped saves. You know, Lenny Melnick dumped saves. That's not a surprise. I think he's been dumping saves like since Jim Constantine was a closer, as I think I made that joke for the second year in a row now. I think it looks like Lohr also dumped saves. Last year there were four guys that dumped saves. This year it looks like three teams dumped saves, although I think some of it depends. You know, Lohr and Dalton Daldon both got some backup guys. So
Derek Carty did also. Well, no, I missed Chapman. He got Chapman early. Yeah. My eyes did not go up that high.
Well, that's what happens sometimes. You're scanning it's really fast, which I didn't want to go through it. But yeah, so three teams dump saves, and yeah, you know, Ken Giles gets some saves eventually, and Kevin Quackenbush, I don't believe in him this year, or Sergio Romo could for Lohr. But you know, point being, as far as the established closers, it was a repeat performance where, you know, Chapman at 21, Craig Kimbrel at 20. You can even say those prices were cheap. You know, Mark Melanson at 18, but they really dropped off. You know, Kenley Jansen went for 12. John Papelbon went for 12. And you can keep pitchers that go to the American League in labor. So I think that's a bargain because Papelbon is probably not waiving his no trade to go set up, especially because it'll cost him a vesting year. So there were, you know, Hector Rondon at 11, Addison Reed at 8, K-Rod at 8. There were just a lot of bargains that were closers, and it's because three teams were just not in the saves game.
Yeah. I will make one quick comment on the reserve round, and it's not a not I think it was a good pick, but I'm still a little surprised at how the bottom has really fallen out for Jeremy Hellickson. He's got no competition for a rotation spot unless he just completely collapses or explodes, and he didn't even go in the first two rounds of the reserve portion of the draft. It's sad. He once held so much promise, and it just all unraveled really, really quickly.
Yeah. Also, you know, I know he's a guy, but what the hell is a Tuffy Goswitch?
Tuffy Goswitch is your starting catcher for the Arizona Diamondbacks.
Oh my god! So that's why Pete. Okay, that makes a lot more sense. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, one of like 10 people could be your starting catcher for the Arizona Diamondbacks.
I heard Mike was in the running for that.
I think I had a bid on Goswitch for three and NL only, and I might bring it down just because nobody's even bidding. Why bid three when I could probably bid one? And hopefully it doesn't even come to that.
Yeah, there's so many ways that they could go with that. I mean, they have Goswitch, they have O'Brien, who they really like, they have Gerald Laird, who is a person. They have Oscar Hernandez, who's the Rule 5 pick, who is just not major league ready at all. But they might try to hide him on the roster. And it, who knows? I still think there, no matter what the situation, like what nice stuff there. And the dollars that Cal Arab spent on Wellington to steal key dollars, very, very well spent. But it'll probably take a month or two to add up. So let's move on to the hitters now, and I kind of want to keep it at the catchers for right now, just because I think it's an interesting comparison between the National League and the American League. In the American League, we had excluding Buster Posey, because Buster Posey is an animal unto his own. He's clearly the best fantasy catcher out there in either league, so there are no comparables for him. But the two top catchers in the American League went for $24 and $21, and that was Evan Gattis and Yan Gomes. And if you flip to the National League, the two best catchers, and you certainly could make the argument that they are better catchers than the ones that went in the American League, were Jonathan Lucroy and Devin Mesoraco, both went for less than $20. Now, I know the two catchers in the American League went to the same owner, but Mike, what are your thoughts on sort of where the catcher market was in general in the National League? Because you noticed some interesting trends when you were in CBS as well with us, right?
Yeah, I think they were a little bit more aggressive in labor in CBS. Like, for example, I got Yachty for 14. He went for 16 to Eric Carabel, which I think was fair, but I thought I got him as a bit of a discount in CBS. And Derek Norris went for 13 to Lorne Michaels. I got him for 10. People definitely paid more of the full freight for catchers. You know, just to compare some CBS labor, since you mentioned it, Miguel Montero, 10 in CBS to our own Keith Cromer, 15 in labor to Wolf and Colton. Willam Rosario went for 12 here. He went for 16 in CBS. That's a bit of a shift the other way. But for the most part, I think what you saw here is you saw a little bit more aggressiveness with the catcher, I think particularly with the first catcher. As far as the backups went, for the most part, people kind of went the cheap route. Really, I think in labor, and this is kind of more common, people really want to stake their claim on the starter. I did think, given the price he's been going for, Devin Mesoraco at 18, now whether you love him or hate him is another story, but compared to his price points, I think that was a good price.
Sounds good. So let's open up to the general hitting environment. The one thing I want to just touch on first, because I found it really interesting, is that the Ambrosius Childs duo grabbed both Billy Hamilton and Dee Gordon in this draft. So they essentially dropped the mic on the steals category. But what do you think of pairing the two together? Both in general and at the prices they went for. Hamilton went for 27 and Gordon went for 26 here.
The prices are fair, and as we know with Gordon last year, if these guys hit the upside, you can get profit. I think that this is a case, though, and you kind of see this with Baseball Prospectus, PECOTA, or other projection systems. If you pay to the projection, and I don't even think that's what Greg Ambrosius did here, but if you pay to the projection, you can wind up with too many steals. And, I kind of look at their team and I look at their offense, and it really looks like the offense is kind of thin. It's also relying on the upside of Chris Bryant. And, hey, if Bryant's terrific, that could be, make a big difference. But I just think there's too many holes, particularly in their outfield, to really make this work. You can trade. This is an FBC, so they could trade one of Gordon or Hamilton early. But as I know from my experience last year in town, when I bought a bunch of speed, including Hamilton, it doesn't always mean that you will trade just because you can.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. $16 on Chris Bryant. What What did Chris Bryant go for in CBS, Mike? Do you remember offhand?
I have it in front of me. He went for 18.
Okay. I couldn't remember whether that was in the same range or not. It's
more or less.
It seems to be a pattern, and I know there's a lot of excitement around Chris Bryant.
I should make a point though that this is an important point about the price between CBS and labor. Since we got on this point, CBS spent $2,081 on the whole on offense. Labor spent $2,225. If my math is right, that's $144 difference. So when you're comparing prices relative to the pool, that's a bigger gap on Bryant than it appears to be.
That is a very, very important point. And when you're paying for Bryant, you're essentially paying if you pay a $16 price tag for Bryant, you are paying for him as though he is about a $20 to $22 player, because you know he's not going to start the season in the major leagues. So you're paying on a especially in an NL only, you're paying on a per game basis. And if he's up May 15th, then you are starting out in a hole that it's going to be tough to make up. And sure, he's extremely talented, and he very well could do it. But I think you're going to get the same owners with the same mindset who end up with Chris Bryant this year, and we'll find out at the end of the season whether those were good buys or not.
Well, he was a 10th most expensive third baseman, and I think, unlike CBS, the prices, again, some of the gap I talked about, but the prices were very different. It's kind of a question of, would you rather have, and these are labor prices, would you rather have Pedro Alvarez at 23, Aramis Ramirez at 18, Chris Bryant at 16, Ryan Zimmerman at 23? These are just some prices that jump out. I think I'd rather have some of these guys than Bryant, but on the other hand, particularly looking at someone like Alvarez, veteran player who's been around a few years, but he has his own kind of risks surrounding him. I might actually rather take Bryant at those two prices if you're comparing the two of them.
Yeah, I did not like Alvarez at that price, but I'd rather, just scanning the third base market.
You'd rather have David Wright, I'm guessing, knowing
you. I'd rather have David Wright at 22. I'd rather have Aramis Ramirez at 18. I'd rather have Nolan Arenado at 24, even though that's a little bit higher up in the range there. So there's certainly guys, but you're right. It has to be looked in the context of the third base market, and there were premiums paid for the third base market, as we've talked about over the course of the offseason. The third base situation in the National League is special.
$9.
Well, that's the other side of it. Do you want Uribe? If you miss out on Bryant, can you live with Uribe at 9, Chris Johnson at 8, or Cody Ash at 6? Those are the guys you're going to live with,
I guess. Yeah. I don't know. If it's me, I'd probably do what Bob Radomski did and grab Kelly Johnson for a buck and just keep my fingers crossed.
Yeah, that is not a bad decision at all.
No, I actually really like that buy at a dollar. I think,
especially, I thought that about Justin Turner at a dollar too. Kind of a similar thing. I know Turner's not going to do what he did last year, but he'll get his playing time and he'll probably earn like $6 or $7.
This price isn't bad at all, but I'm just, Will Middlebrook's got $8.
Well, that tied kind of into the end game where people were floating around. I think I mentioned this before, with just too much money, and they kind of had to push guys up or leave their money behind.
Yeah.
Steve Gardner was one of those owners. I think it was Steve and Derek Van Riper of RotoWire. They both had, I don't know the exact amounts, but they both had like $20 or $30 left and a lot of holes to fill.
Yeah. That's not uncommon for a
Yeah, and you see it on their teams. You know, Steve got Brian Peña for 4, Will Muddybrooks for 8, and Gervis Salarde for 7, Gerardo Parra for 4, and Derek got Alex Guerrero for 3, Zach Kozar for 4, Dylson Herrera for 2, Mark Reynolds for 4, Cameron Maben for 3, Chris Zdenorfia for 2. There's nothing wrong with any of these guys at these prices. It's just that, particularly in Derek's case, if you have so many guys like that on your team, you really need like 2 or 3 of them to hit. Like, Derek kind of looks like he fell into a quasi Stars and Scrubs. And I just think, you know, unless this is the year that Bryce Harper goes nuts, I think he's going to have a hard time.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing with going Stars and Scrubs in an only, is that you really gotta, if you miss on even one star, you're sunk. I mean, he has Goldschmidt, Harper, and Puig. If one of those guys is not the guy that he's hoping he is, well, then
the other problem is that Puig and Harper, they both haven't done it yet. Like, they both haven't earned that. You know, I hear a few people say this, and you know, I think it's Rick Wolf who was in this draft. You know, it's that rule of don't pay a guy more than he's ever earned. And, you know, those guys, Harper came close, actually, but those guys haven't done it. So for them to be the stars, they got to take that step forward. By the way, since we're on Derek's team, I wanted to mention Javi Baez. And, you know, even experts have, like, biases. Baez, I think, struck out 3 times on the day of NL Labor, and I definitely think that impacted his price. I mean, without a doubt. Well, I saw people talking about it, like, you know, right before. I think Baez goes for 14 or 15 if that doesn't happen.
Yeah, and you look at it on the – I was noticing on the American League side too, right? That draft happened the night after Carlos Rodon looked nasty in his Correct. In his start, right, and went for $7 in the auction. And that wouldn't have happened, I imagine, at least if the auction was – maybe a week ago, but
yeah. Now Baez did come out early, and I think there were a couple guys. You know, Yasmani Grandal is another one who came out early and went for 11. There were a couple guys like that who came out early and went a little cheaply as a result. So that could have been part of it with Baez too. And it comes out early. There's already your crowd that's like, there's no way in hell I'm owning Baez. But there's probably another crowd that's like, well, I would have paid 13 or 14 for him, but let's see how things shake out. The room's still, you know, it's early. I don't want to commit to Baez up the middle and then see somebody go later at a price. You know, what's really funny about that is that, you know, I'm no Bias fan, but I'd rather have him than say Jose Peraza, who went really late for 10. And, you know, some of these other guys I see, I'd rather have Bias at 11 than Scooter Gennett at 16. Gennett could earn 16. I'd just rather play the Bias upside. And even in only, if I get burned, I look at it like, you know what? The upside was there to make the play.
Yeah, and that's one that you look at and that feels painful. 16 for Gannett, but I mean there were well, you know, the buys at second base were few and far between. I mean, there's even guys who are trying to bounce back. I mean, Jed Jerko went for 17. I mean, you know, I think we're both going to gravitate towards the same thing. But I, the only guy who I think was a decent buy was Aaron Hill at $12. That price I like.
Yeah, everybody really went par or like a little. You know, I think Chase Utley at 15 is okay. I think Daniel Murphy at 18 is okay. But yeah, even a guy like DJ LeMay, who usually you think, you know, he'll earn 9 or 10, I'll get him for 5 or 6. He went for 10. Like, it's just, there's just not, there are the guys like, you know, no upside in them at their prices. You know, we talk about Brandon Phillips. I got him in CBS. I got him for 10, and you're like, yeah, it could be a good pick. Here at 16, it's kind of like, yeah, you know, it's now he's got to bounce back. It's not just a matter of him showing up and not getting hurt. At that price, you got to get the bounce back. If you don't, you're going to take a loss.
Yeah. And, you know, it's fun to look at these rosters and the way they turned out. You have, you know, you have people who you expect to do certain things, And they, you know, they do them. And, you know, we talked about sort of the consistency of labor and what that means. I mean, look, I like Eric Carabel's sort of group of fillies.
He does that every year, I think.
I know. He's got Cody Ashe, he's got Odubel Herrera, he's got Michael Franco, Ben Revere. I'm pretty sure he took Jake Diekman in the reserve round, right? Yeah.
He did.
So yeah, Eric's a Phillies guy, and actually he lives, for people haven't heard that, he lives one town from me in, you know, in the Philly area. So yeah, he's a big Phillies guy.
Yeah. And the God knows they have enough of a dearth of talent on that roster that any of those guys could, you know, find themselves with 500 at bats and certainly earn their prices. But it's always just it's amusing. So any other prices or guys that jump out to you guys here?
I think we touched on the big ones. I mean, you know, the Alvarez stuff was interesting. The whole second base situation was pretty weird. I think we got it.
Yeah, I do. You know, one price I kind of wanted to mention is Carlos Gonzalez going for 23.
Yep.
We know that we like him, or Brett and I like him, but even if you don't like him, you know, you kind of look at some of these other prices of guys. You know, Starlin Castro also went for 23. Alvarez, who we mentioned, went for 23. Matt Holliday and Jason Hayward went for 23. I think a lot of these prices, like Hayward's price is fine. I think Kemp's price is fine. But Cargo at that price just has the upside there. And, you know, unless he has another weird season where he plays 80 games and has kind of the strange injuries he had last year, like the mass on his hand and the appendicitis, he could actually be a bargain this year at that price.
Yeah, he went for less than Marcelo Zuna, Gregory Polanco, and Christian Yelich. And I am one of the captains of the Christian Yelich fan club, but that does not register for me. And it's not that I don't like those three guys, but Cargo at that price is deserving of applause.
Yep.
And there's a lot of symmetry there, right? Eric got four outfielders that cost exactly $23.
Yeah, I noticed that with the first three. I was like, oh my God, that's weird.
It looks pretty on the spreadsheet.
It does. It's kind of cool.
That it is. So that's all I got, if anyone has anything else? Otherwise,
I'll save it for the recaps this week. And you know, if you're listening to this, the AL recap should be out, so you'll get to read all about this. And best of all, it's free.
I just want to say that the names in the reserve list are very strong. I mean, Vogelsong we're kind of used to, but Spangenberg, Goswitch, Holtzkum,
Neuenheis,
Ziegler, strong names. There's some strong names down here.
Schwarbs. Love me some Schwarbs.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. Actually, while we're looking at the reserves, the one guy I want to mention as a reserve pick I really, really liked was taken by the Wolfen and Colton team. It was Yuri Perez, way down in the fifth round of the reserve. He's going to make the Braves. And BJ or Melvin Upton, whatever he's calling himself now, is likely still going to be terrible. And Perez is a very good defensive center fielder who can steal some bases. So that's a guy who I really like as a reserve pick in an NL. You hear that, Mike?
Yeah, I'm just kind of... Mike, I heard that.
Mike has been frayed already.
That's true.
I'm just, you know, I don't want to give away too many of the NL secrets before Tout Wars. I'm always like, can we just move on and like talk about stuff?
That's true. All right, so let's move on. We gotta close this out. It's that time. So Well, should we cut to the music?
Yeah, let's take a break and we'll be right back.
All right.
What he said. And thank you for listening to episode 46 of Flags Fly Forever. We have, as always, been a baseball prospectus fantasy podcast. You've been listening to myself, Brett Sayer, Mike Gianella, and Mauricio Rubio. You can read all of us at baseballprospectus.com, so you should go there today and subscribe and get all of our great fantasy content. We just wrapped our positional series, and the content is going to continue full force until draft day. And then, it's not going to stop draft day either. It's going to go through the entire season, and it's going to be awesome. So come join us for the ride. And if you subscribe to a super premium membership, you get access to the bat signal, and your computer or phone will automatically auto-correct things to the incorrect spelling. But on a serious note, you can ask us anything you like, and we will answer it, and we are there as a resource for you, the fantasy owner. So that is it. We will be back next week on some sort of schedule. Next Monday, both Mao and I will be in Arizona, where the weather will be warmer and the baseball will be live. So our next episode will be up at some point. We don't know when yet. You will find out soon. But that's all. Have a good night, and we'll see you next week. Bye bye.
Good night.
Bye, everyone.
Oh man, it's gonna be so good.